Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. I apologize for the slightly late start. There were enormous troubles on the road today. Actually, it took me more than an hour and a half to get here from Gush Etzion, which is a bit strange. So at least we're here. Be'ezrat Hashem. I'm very happy to be back with you after Pesach. I'd like to ask if you could please turn off your cell phones so that we can get through the shiur without some musical entertainment. And also I'd like to thank the sponsors for the fall 2024 academic year. The shiurim have been sponsored Le'ilu Nishmois Brana Bas Brandit and Zelig Ben Kalman, Zichronam Livrocha, and we are very, very grateful to that anonymous donor. The topic that I'd like to deal with, even though it was in the Torah Tibbetz, Am Yisrael at War, we've dealt with a lot of those topics. There's still more to talk about, but I actually want to move away from that specific topic. Not that there's not important things to discuss, but I think we need to move on to other things as well. I'd like in the run-up to Shavuot to talk about something we haven't really dealt with in this forum before, and in some cases not for a very long time, which is the actual Sefer Torah itself, the thing which is at the very heart of Judaism, Matan Torah, Kabbalah Satorah, receiving Torah. What is the nature, the halachic nature of the Sefer Torah that we had, that we have? Today, I did give you a preview as to what I mean by this. Today, I'd like to talk about how the Torah was written, how the Torah was communicated, and why that makes any difference to us 3,300 years later, which we'll see, I think it really does. Next week, I want to look at the issue of the accuracy of the Sefer Torah, and how do we know what psukim were allowed into the Sefer Torah. There are all sorts of interesting questions that come up on that. We'll allude to that a little bit today, and talk a little bit about the Ibn Ezra, but the Ibn Ezra will come mostly next week. Then 3 weeks from now, I'd like to talk about the font of the Sefer Torah, the script of the Sefer Torah, and how that fundamentally changed, or did it, and whether that matters to us today, and why it should or shouldn't make any difference. So these are all actually very central issues to what is Torah and what is the Sefer Torah. Climbing the ladder, that's good. At least we're going up. And then maybe the week before Shavuos we'll get a chance to do something a little bit different. Or maybe we'll stay on that theme. So we'll see. Okay, for now, hopefully you have a source sheet, and we will look at that together. It's actually very good timing, because not only is it before Shavuos, but it's also Parshas Behar. And those two things are not actually coincidental, because the year, the reading of the Sefer Torah in Shul is set up in such a way that the end of Vayikra coincides pretty much with Shavuot. So we'll see how that works and why Behar is important. So look at number one. Some of these issues are well known, but some of them actually are really, really not. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Behar Sinai le'mor. So suddenly in Parshas Behar, at the beginning of the Parsha, we see another reference to Har Sinai. Now Har Sinai, the theophany at Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah, was in the middle of Shemot. We're already towards the end of Vayikra. Why do we have a new reference to Har Sinai? And of course, quite famously, Rashi asked the question, which has made its way into modern Ivrit as well. Ma inyan shmita etzel Har Sinai? What on earth does shmita have to do any more than anything else with Har Sinai? We've had loads and loads of mitzvahs since Har Sinai. Number two, says Rashi, v'halo kol ha-mitzvahs nemru b'Sinai. Weren't all the mitzvahs given on Sinai? Well, that's a good question. Were they or weren't they? We'll see. Ella, he gives an answer from Toras Kohanim. Ma shmita nemruha klaloteha upratoteha v'digdukeha m'Sinai. Just like we see here in Parshas Behar, the details for the first time of shmita. We had shmita in outline in Parashat Mishpatim, but now we have all the details. So it's telling us these details that we see today in Behar, nemru klaloteha pratoteha v'digdukeha b'Sinai. Not just the general ideas, but the details and the very fine details were given on Sinai. So avkolam nemru klaloteha v'digdukeha b'Sinai. So too, all the mitzvahs. This is like a binyan av. This is setting up a paradigm. All the mitzvot we learn from here were given not just in their outline, but in their detail and in their very fine detail at Sinai. I can hear talking. Is that, it's an echo. Okay, well, at least I'm talking to myself, I suppose. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Okay, we shouldn't play with any buttons or it might stop working. But it is a little bit off-putting. Maybe we could ask for some technical help. We'll see if the voice at the back is saying the same shit as the voice at the front. Okay, fine. So, v'nira li shekach perusha. So what does that mean, says Rashi? I want to tell you, he says, this was from Kach Shnui B'Torah's Kohenim. This is what we read in Chazal. But what does that mean, that the details were all given on Sinai? And he says a very interesting thing. Lefi sheloi matzinu shmitat karkaos shenishneis ba'arvos moav b'mishne Torah. He says, because when you look in Dvarim, there is no more reference to the Shemitah on land, which is unusual because Dvarim is meant to be a repetition of the Torah. It's not every mitzvah that's repeated, but Shemitah is not repeated. So Lamadnu, so we're learning, because we don't see it later, Sheklaloseu Pratoteho Kulam Nemru Misinai, that the details were actually not given later, but they were given earlier. Ubakatu Velamit Kan, and the Posik here tells us, Al Kol Dibur Shinibaba Moshe B'Sinai, every single thing that was given to Moshe on Sinai, Hayukulam Klaloseim Vidiktukeim, Vechazru Venishnu Ba'arvas Moav. This is actually very interesting. What Rashi is doing, he is giving us an explanation of what is a very fundamental idea, that the Torah, at least according to Rabbi Akiva, we'll see, was given three times. It was given at Sinai, Venishnu, and it was given Nishnu Sheni a second time in the Ohel Moed, in the tabernacle, Venishtalshu, and it was given a third time in the Arvas Moed, in the book of Dvarim. These are basically what we call the book of Shemot, the book of Vayikra, and the book of Dvarim. And he's saying the fact that we're seeing these details here, not later, and it's referring to Har Sinai explicitly, is telling us this principle, that the details were given, and then given again, and then given again. So why is this so important to know? Why is he stressing this in this way? So what Rashi is doing, he's quoting here from Torah's Kohanim, but we also have this in the Gemara itself. The Gemara in number 3, if you look with me, please. Rabbi Shmuel Omer. So Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva have a fundamental difference of opinion. Rabbi Shmuel says, Klalois Nemru B'Sinai, that the what we got at Sinai, what we're celebrating on Shavuos, or for that matter, by the way, on Yom Kippur, because Shavuos was the first Luchos, if you like, which were the abortive Luchos, but the idea of Sinai is just the klalim, just the outlines. Moshe got like an overview, the chapter headings. These are the things that we're going to get into over the coming years together. Upratos, but the details were in the Ohel Moed. Okay, so let's just look down for a second at Rashi number 4, is how he's explaining Rabbi Shmuel. So number 4, klalos nemru b'sinai. Harbe dvarim nemru stumim b'sinai. Many things were given in a very simple way to Moshe at Har Sinai. Stam. Shelo nitparshu kol tzarchem. And they weren't elaborated upon, says Rabbi Yishmael. This is very important for you to know. Sinai was an overall experience. Upeirshu loy, but they were explained to Moshe, and I underlined the law, la'acha kuhukam ha-mishkam ba'ohel moed. After the Mishkan was set up in the Ohel Moed. So as you know, Sinai came to an end, the people heard the Torah at Sinai, and they were given the mitzvah to build the Mishkan. There is a major debate, which we'll get back to later, between Rashi and the Rambam, on the one hand, who says that the mitzvah to build the tabernacle was only after the sin of the golden calf, as a response to the sin of the golden calf. Maybe we wouldn't have needed a tabernacle and Ohel Moed, if not for the lowering of the levels, to be addressed in a minute. And of course, the Ramban, who we're going to see also soon, who says no, the Mishkan was given before. If you look in the Parshas, it goes Mishpatim, and then it goes Yisro, Mishpatim, Teruma, Tetzave, Kisisa, Vayakel, Pekude. There's an order. The golden calf happens after the Mishkan was commanded. And he says, I want to keep the Parshas in order wherever I possibly can. And therefore, the Mishkan is fundamental. It's not a bedieved. It's not something that came later. It's fundamental to the idea of there being Sinai that can move around with them. So Rabbi Yishmael says, okay, that's fine. But Sinai was the outline. And the Mishkan, which was the next Shlav Bet, was the detail. Upratas Bo'el Moed, look in Rashi number 4, line 2. Mishehukam HaMishkan, once they directed the Mishkan, V'diber imo me'alap kaporet, and Moshe communicated with God, God spoke to him over the kaporet, with the wings of the Kruvim. So then at that point, Sham Piresh Lo Hakatuv. That's when God explained all the details to him. Now, by the way, nobody has spoken yet about when Moshe gives it over to the people and when they eventually write it down. All that's being discussed right now is when did it get from God to Moshe? And Rabbi Yishmael says the outline was at the beginning, but the details came later. Now flip back to number 3 and look at Rabbi Akiva. For Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says, no, which is what Rashi quoted in number 2, Klalois Upratois Nemru B'Sinai. All the details were given at Sinai. V'nishnu ba'ohel moed, and they were given again at the ohel moed. V'nishtalshu, and they were given a third time ba'arvas moav, in the plains of Moav in Devarim. So it wasn't just an outline at the beginning. Everything was given. Then everything was given again. And then everything was given again. So the question is, why do we need to get this 3 times? And is it different? Has it changed the second and the third time? But there has to be this 3-fold pattern. Yeah. Which time? Which 40 days? The first ones or the second ones? So the first ones, he was being taught the Torah. He was being taught the first Torah. He was... Okay, so you're saying, according to Rabbi Ishmael, why does it take 40 days to get... Maybe I'm not saying what you're thinking. You're asking, why does it take 40 days just to get the outline? Or you're not asking that?
No, I'm asking if he went up for 40 days 2 times, then maybe he was given the Torah 5 times.
Well, I don't know where you... I don't know where you get 5 times exactly from, but there were various lots of 40. There was 40 at the beginning, and then the golden calf, and then there was 40 dealing with the people, and then there was 40 davening for Slicha, and then there was another 40 receiving the second Torah. We'll see a little bit the Ramban. We'll come on to that. So what's with this 3-fold repetition? Just look for a second back in number 4. Look back at Rashi on Rabbi Akiva. Nishnu, third line of number 4. Nishnu Pam Shenit, he was given over a second time. The Kal Masha Nema Kan Nema Kan. And it was the same, says Rashi. What was said here, the Afal Pishelo Nichtav. But don't think that anything was written down. Nothing was written down. Nothing was written down yet. That's interesting. All that Moshe got at the beginning was the Luchos. They were smashed. He got another set of Luchos, but nothing else was written down, says Rashi. Don't think they had a Sefer Torah. Many of my students have this idea that Moshe walked down Har Sinai with a Luchos in one hand and a Sefer Torah in the other hand. Rashi said, no. Nobody says that. Nothing's written yet. And then look at the last line of Rashi. Nishtal Shuba Arvas Moav, and it was given a third time in the plains of Moav, Mipi Moshe Israel. That was when it was communicated. That's when Moshe gives it all over in Sefer Dvarim. So, this is really interesting. Did the Jewish people know anything before Sefer Dvarim? Or did they just act as an as-needs basis? What you need to know in order to do this or to do that, etc. And it's actually interesting because the Jewish people are asking Moshe, what about this? What about that? We don't know about Pesach Sheni. We don't know about Benot Slavchad. So this is making more sense because it could be that a lot of the details were just not given to them until the final Shlav. Shnei Maron, he brings the Posik there. Now, what I brought you in the bottom of the page was something which actually my daughter, bless her, did many, many years ago. I even attributed to her here. Research and graphics by Yael Manning, based on Sefer HaChinuch. When she was about 8 or 9, she's Baruch Hashem now 27, I asked her to do, hence the very simple graphic. I asked, she'd probably do something much more flashy today, but I asked her to plot on a graph the number of mitzvot given in each parsha, according to Sefer HaChinuch, with the parsha itself. And lo and behold, what do you see? You see this kind of ECG, this electrocardiogram of Torah, where you see that very little is given in Bereishis, because Bereishis is not a book of mitzvot. But then you get a peek around Bat, Yisro, Mishpatim, etc. That's Sinai, what Rabbi Akiva calls Sinai. And then it kind of dies down again a little bit, and then you get a second peak, which is bigger than the first peak, which is what we call Ohel Moed, that is Sefer Vayikra, especially the parshas we've just been reading, Kedoshim, and Achremos, and Emor, etc. And then it really dies down through Sefer Bamidbar, and then at the very end, you get an even bigger peak, a third peak in Sefer Dvarim, which is the, if you like, the last pulse of the Torah. It's very, very visual now that you see what Rabbi Akiva was getting at when he talks about 3 pulses of Torah. Very, very fascinating. And of course, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. Because after the Torah was given the first time, there was no tochacha. There was no warning at the end of Shemot, don't mess up, because nobody had messed up until, or I should say in Mishpatim, there was no warning. Then they did mess up. So that was the Egel Hazav. So they messed up. So when the Torah is re-given, which Rashi said was the same, but we'll see in a minute that's not so clear, it was given in Vayikra with a tochacha at the end that we're about to read in Bechukosai, which is, this is Shlav Bet. Well, it's not really Shlav Bet, because don't forget, plan A was Gan Eden, and plan B was Noach, and plan C was Avraham. We're already on plan F or G, but the second download of Torah is given with a tochacha. Just don't mess up this time. And of course they did. They messed up with the Chetam Araglim, with the sin of the spies. So when it's given a third time, it's given with Dvarim, with a mega tochacha, with a much bigger tochacha, which is really, 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 take me seriously, don't mess up this time. Whether they did or didn't is the rest of Jewish history, which I'm not getting into now. But you see this pulse of the Torah, which is Rabbi Akiva's understanding, which is what Rashi was there alluding to. So go over the page. I have a little bit less time than I thought I would, so I'm not going to read the Ramban inside. But the Ramban at the beginning of Bahar says, not so quick. Meaning, where were they in Sefer Vayikra? Where were they situated in Sefer Vayikra? And the answer is, at Har Sinai. They didn't leave Har Sinai until Sefer Bamidbar. And therefore, when the Chazal talk about what was given at Sinai, Ramban says, don't just think it means the first Shlav in Mishpatim, in Shmot. But everything that's given through Shmot and through Vayikra is all called at Sinai. It just depends whether you're talking about plan A, which was what was given before the golden calf. And then the Ramban said, that was completely scrubbed. I just want to bring you one line from the Ramban. Maybe go to the fourth line where it says Lamosha. You see what I mean by Lamosha? Fourth line of number five. He talks about when when Moshe finally received a slicha, received atonement from God for the sin of the golden calf, beluchos shniyos, with the second luchos, tzivau bebrit chadasha. He had a whole new covenant. As it says, Shneemar, Hine Anochi Koret Brit. This is Kisisa afterwards. The Hichsi Shama Mitzvahs Hachamuros Shneemru Beseder VeElu Mishpatim. So he got back the key, the really chomor, the very serious, stringent mitzvahs that he'd had the first time round. Okay, which he'd got in Eila Mishpatim, Bebrit Rishona, and he brings the pasuk. Varatzah Kodesh Baruch Hu Lahachmir Aleihem Bebrit Hazot Hashenit. But God needed to push down on them further with this second Brit. Why? It's not the same as the first Brit. And there's a tochacha at the end. So Ramban is saying something very interesting, which is when the Torah is given over again in Vayikra, it's not quite the same Torah. It's a different Torah suited for a different group of people. It has the same basic outline. We still have Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. But by the way, if you look carefully, there are some things in Vayikra that we never had in Shemot. In Shemot, we didn't have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Well, that kind of makes sense, because the whole process of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Slicha makes more sense now in a post-sin world than in a pre-sin world. We also have Shmini Atzeres. But we also have more than that. And I want to look at the Sforno, because look at the Sforno in number 6. Says the Sforno at the beginning of the mitzvahs of Kashrus in Sefer Vayikra. Zot hachaya asher tochelu. These are the animals that you're allowed to eat. So he picks up on an interesting point, which is, why are there no trefa animals in Sefer Shmos? They only appear in Sefer Vayikra. In Sefer Shmos, you've got milk and meat as a prohibition, but you've got no trefa animals. Also in Sefer Shmos, you've got a number of the sexual prohibitions that come up in Vayikra, don't appear in Shmot. You've got no nida. You only have nida in Vayikra. You only have trefa animals in Vayikra. He said, is there a reason for this? So the Sforno in Italy, 500 years ago, says the following. After the Jews had been stripped of their spiritual jewelry, as it were, from Kisisa after the calf, shekanu b'matan Torah, which they got a matan Torah, so they'd now gone down a level. And before they lost this, Shechina had been able to rest on them, bilti emtza'i, without any intermediary, the Jewish people were on such a level. Ka'amru, like it says in at the end of Parshas Yisro, B'chol amokam asher azki et shmi avo elecha uberachticha. He's going with Rashi's approach and the Rambam's approach, which is they didn't need a Sefer Vayikra, they didn't need a Mishkan until they went down that level. And then he says something very subtle but super controversial. K'mo sheyihye ha'inyan la'atid lavo. As it will be one day again in the future. What does that mean? Are we going to go back to the level of Har Sinai? Okay, we'll see. After we went down, Ma'as Hakel Baruch Hu Achar Kach Mehashrot Od Shechinaso Beinehem Klal. The God refused. It was not possible for the Shechinah to rest on them. Ka'amru, because it says there, Ki lo ele bekirbecha, bekirbecha. I'm not going to be with you directly anymore. Hisik Moshe Rabbeinu b'tfilasoy. And Moshe managed, he achieved through tefillah, Eze Tikkun, to get back some of what was lost. Shetishra Hashchinah b'tocham be'emtza'ut mishkan. That you can now have a connection with God, but only through a mishkan. The kelav, umsharatav, uzvachav. Now you have korbonos, and now you have kelim, and gold, and silver, and sprinkling, and blood. That was never, says the Sfarno, the original plan. We didn't need that originally. Until you get in Parsha Shmini, God reappears. Eish comes down from Shemaim. So now, the second time around, God had to kind of improve their new low level and get them back somewhere closer to where they were before. So they'd be able to receive this new light. So they had to have new restrictions. I'm sorry guys, he says, there's new food that you can't eat. After the golden calf, you're on a new level. Now you can't eat pigs, and now you can't eat shellfish, and now you can't eat insects, etc. Before you did the sin, maybe you would have been fine eating everything. But now you have the laws of kashrus, okay? And also the laws of tolada, of sexual relations. The asa es amachalim hamatameim, and he prohibited, God prohibited in Vayikra, tray food, ve'et ha'nefesh, be'midos u'muskalos, ka'amru ve'el, al tashaksu es nafshoseichem, you don't make yourself disgusting, this is all new, ve'his kadishtem, ve'isim kadoshim, the asa hanida v'hazava v'hayoledet. And now we have a whole tranche of new prohibitions, nida, zava, yoledet, which it sounds from the Sforno, we would never have needed those had we only just been able to avoid the sin of the golden calf. This is a very interesting thesis, and it becomes even more interesting when you know what he said before, which is, and one day we're going to get back there. One day we're going to get back there. We're going to go back to that place where we don't need Sefer Vayikra. We're back on the level of the Har Sinai. So what does that mean? Does that mean that when Mashiach comes, or whatever Shlav he's talking about, we're going to just jettison certain ideas from the Torah and go back to this pre-Vayikra reality? So actually, that is exactly what the Kabbalists say. That is exactly what the Ramban says. He doesn't, as far as I can recall, refer specifically to treif animals and nida. But if you look at Ramban there on Devarim, where he talks about the, you know, God will circumcise your heart and you'll come back, he says we'll go back to a level where we don't need the Torah anymore. It's a whole Brit Chadashah. Now, this may not sit comfortably on your ears, because according to Maimonides, it's entirely heretical. Because the ninth of the principles of faith is the Torah will never change. It can't change. Mitzvahs will be mitzvahs. When we die, go to Shamayim. You know, ultimately, we don't need mitzvahs in Shamayim, because we have no bodies in Shamayim. But as long as we've got bodies, we need mitzvahs. And mitzvahs can only be one thing. Yes, sir. He'll give it a different shot. Tahorist doesn't, Torah might just mean without a mum, clear, like a pshat level, without any blemishes. It doesn't mean that they were dafka kosher and not kosher. That's a drash that's broadly there. Tameis and Tahorist don't dafka mean kosher, not kosher. Don't know, could give a different reading. So this idea of the Sfarno is actually very interesting, and we don't have time for this now, but if you look in the Midrashim, which fuel the kind of Sabbatean heresies that started happening in the 1660s and post-Shabtai Tzvi, the things that Chazal, in those Midrashim which were pulled out, focus on that we will change in the world to come, like the Sfarno being will to come here, meaning Yemos HaMashiach, are things like Chazir. Why is the Chazir called a Chazir? Because it is Chozer to its level of Kashrus. the pigs will become kosher. And nida, which was introduced, will be rolled back, etc. Now, the Rambam gets very, very uncomfortable when you start talking about that, because he says, number one, no mitzvahs will change. Number two, Mashiach is not going to be a mystical, spiritual, only reality. It's going to be a real nuts and bolts, physical reality. So what you have baked into this question of when was the Torah given and what was given and when was it given is actually some really fundamental hashkafic ideas which have driven different movements within the Jewish people over certainly the last 500 years, but probably much longer than that. In a kind of roundabout kind of way, the Reform movement was also playing into this idea. The Reform movement in the 19th century, obviously there were other drivers and reasons as well, many, were saying, well, this is our utopia. We have been emancipated. We have been allowed into non-Jewish society. This is what they meant when they talked about Yemos HaMashiach, Olam Haba. They focused not on the person, but on the period, Yemos HaMashiach. Therefore, why do we need mitzvot? They were coming off this idea. And in fact, there are some interesting theories about whether the early Reform leaders had connections with Sabbatean underground tendencies. You can do your PhD on that if you're interested. There's all sorts of things to talk about there. Now, of course, as I said, the Reform movement were coming from a lot of other practical places too, but there's a lot going on. So that's the first reason why this is not just a theoretical, you know, conversation about what was given when, but it actually drives some very interesting contemporary questions. Let's move on to the next question. When was it written down? All of this is about when it was given over to Moshe. And Moshe gives it over to the people. When was it written down? So the Chumash seems to be explicit. Look in number 7. V'yichtov Moshe es haTorah hazos. This is at the end of Dvarim. Moshe is about to die. He writes down the Torah. V'yitna el Kohanim, and he gives it to the Kohanim b'nei Levi hanosim et Aaron b'rit Hashem v'el kol zikne Yisrael. V'ata, and says to God, and he says to the people rather, kisvu lachem et hashira hazot. Write down this shira. Why is the Torah being called a Shira? Now you might say, well, this could be Shirat Ha'azinu. It's another way of approaching it. Absolutely. But write down this Shira. V'lam dad b'nei Yisrael simu b'fihem. Put it in there. Write it down and give it over. Put it in their mouths. L'man t'yeli ha'shira hazot le'ed b'nei Yisrael. So that this will be a testimony to them. And then it says at the end there, v'hi k'chalot Moshe l'chtov et divrei ha'torah hazot. When Moshe had finished writing down this Torah, our Sefer, in its book, ad tumam. What does ad tumam mean? In its complete sense, we'll see in a minute why that's a question. So Moshe then commands Levim, and he says to them, take this sefer. You now have a sefer Torah, and put it next to the Aaron, and it will be for you a master copy. This will be your master copy of the Torah. Any future Torah has to be compared with this one and written accurately. Keep that idea in your mind till next week, please, when we talk about those ideas. Okay, so when was the Torah written down? It sounds like it was written down at the end. And that's kind of what Rashi said before when we said, when we talked about when it was given over, he said, no, nothing was written, nothing was written. And then later it seems to have been written. And in fact, this is also debated by Chazal, which is a question, why would Chazal care? Why would Chazal introduce a discussion as to when and how the Torah was written? Chazal lived thousands of years after this point of time, just like you and I do. So why are they interested? We'll see that in a minute. Number 8, very important source here. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Benosa. Rabbi Yochanan says the following. Torah Megillah Megillah Nitna. The Torah was given in Megillot. It was given in scrolls. It was given in installments. Megillah Megillah. And he brings a pasuk, which I'm not getting into exactly now. But look at Rashi. Again, sorry to have you flipping around. But look at Rashi number 9, Megillah, Megillah, Nitna. He explains, Kishinemra parsha leMoshe. When Moshe was given a parsha, haya kotva, he would write it down himself. Ulebesoif mem shana, but at the end of the 40 years, what did he do? Kishenigmru kol haparshus, when they'd all been given, chibran v'gidin, begidin v'tafran, he joined them together and sewed them all up. And now you have a Sefer Torah. So according to Rashi, the first view, Megillah, Megillah, is that Rashi is writing all this stuff down, Moshe is writing this stuff down, putting it in a drawer, saying, let's keep this safe. And then at the end of Moshe's life, God says, okay, put it all together. Sew it up, put it together. And actually that is how you write a Sefer Torah today. They don't just take an enormous scroll and start from the beginning and get to the end. You can write a Sefer Torah in any order you like. You can start in Dvarim and you can go on to Breishis, and you write one luach at a time and keep them in the drawer, and then at the end you put them all together, which is of course not the case with mezuzot and tefillin, which have to be written in order. There is a din with a mezuzah that if you make a mistake in the middle of a mezuzah and you realize that you've gone on and there's a mistake in the middle, you can't just correct the mistake. With a Sefer Torah, you can correct the mistake. It doesn't have to be in the exact order for reasons that will become evident soon. And you may have been in shul on a weekday when someone's noticed a mistake in the Sefer Torah and somebody, a handy guy there with a quill and a bit of ink, has come up and looked and said, yes, all done. We're done. It's easy. You can't do that with a mezuzah. If you notice a mistake in a mezuzah, what the sofer has to do is he has to scratch out all the letters going back to where the mistake was and then write it back properly from there. And if by scratching that out he hits Shem Hashem on the way, then he's finished, because you can't scratch out Shem Hashem. So in he goes to the Geniza and we start all over again. That is why mezuzahs are, in terms of proportional to the number of words in them, much, much, much more expensive than buying a Sefer Torah. If you think how much it costs to buy a mezuzah and how little there is written on it and how much it costs to buy a Sefer Torah, it's not like the same proportion, because Sefer Torah are less stressful in that sense to write. Okay, that's Megillah, Megillah. Okay, go back to number 8. Second line, Reb Shimon ben Lachish. So this is Rabbi Yochanan versus Reish Lakish. Rabbi Shimon ben Lachish, in number 8, second line, says, no, the Torah wasn't written Megillah, Megillah. I'm on number 8. Torah chatuma nitna. The Torah was given chatuma. What's a chatima? It's a seal. It's one unit. It was given in one go. Go back to Rashi number 9. Chatuma nitna. Lo nichtava. According to this view, it wasn't written at all. At Saif Mem, until the end of 40 years, La'acha Shenemru Kol HaParshus Kolom, till everything was already explained to Moshe, whenever, wherever it was explained, in Sinai, in Ohal Moed, in Arvas Moav. V'hanemoros loy b'shana rishona v'shnia, and all the Torah he got in the first and second year, i.e., Breishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, first part of Bamidbar, hayusudurot lo al peh, it was all Torah shebal peh, until it was written at the end. Now that's actually very interesting, because according to the second approach, there were no installments. The Torah was written in one go, right at the end. According to Megillah, Megillah, there were installments. By the way, maybe not even that many. Just flip over very quickly to number 10. You'll see that the Ramban, when he talks about Megillah, Megillah, he says even Megillah, Megillah only means two installments. The Rashi thought it meant like Every time Moshe wrote something down, he pushes it in the drawer. The Rabban says, no, Megillah, Megillah is literally Megillah, Megillah. One Megillah up to Har Sinai, everything up to that point, and another Megillah, maybe you'll call it the Ganser Megillah, okay, at the very end where he gets the whole thing. So even according to Megillah, Megillah, says the Ramban, it might not be 50 installments, it might just be two installments. But my question for you is, why do I care? Why does this matter? Why are we talking about this? I have a Sefer Torah now. I know what it is. When, however it was said over and written down, doesn't seem very relevant. And of course the answer is, it's highly relevant. Because it goes to the question of how do I read the Sefer Torah? How do I interpret the Sefer Torah? How do I learn the Sefer Torah? And one of the things that we've been zoche to over the last 40, 50 years is a whole revival in Parshanut on the Torah. Even when I was growing up, and I'm not so old, there was nothing like the amount of breadth out there of Parsha ideas. The whole Gush Etzion-type Torah, the Bar Ilan academic but religiously focused Torah that's coming out of Rav Yoni Grossman and English Etzion of Rav Yol Bin Nun. This is all a new growth, which is very exciting. Now, some people are not so keen on it, some people are very into it, but really, what we're talking about is how do I read this book? Do I read this book in way X or way Y? And I'll tell you what I mean. If the Torah was written Megillah, Megillah, let's go with Rashi's most expansive understanding. Moshe writes it down, puts it in the drawer. Writes it down, puts it in the drawer. It's a bit like a diary. You know, you write February the 5th, put it in the drawer. Later you write August the 5th, put it in the drawer. December the 10th, put it in the drawer. Does the entry on February the 5th know what's happening in December in a diary? And the answer is No, how can it know? It's in installments. The earlier installments, by definition, do not yet anticipate the later installments. It's installments. Even if you take the Ramban, it's still two installments. But if you take the view that no, everything is Baal Peh, everything says right in the Chatuma approach is between God and Moshe. And at the very end of his life, he says, okay, now this is how I want you to write it down. This is the form I want the written version to take. Now ask yourself, does Sefer Bereishis already know what's happening in Sefer Dvarim? Yes, because it's not an installment. It's like a novel. Can a novel, I mean, Lahavdil, we'll see in a minute the literature comparison. Can a novel start at the end and then flashback? Of course it can. And it sometimes does. And he uses flashbacks and flash forwards and also, why? Because the person writing the novel has the whole thing in front of them and they're writing it in such a way which thematically is designed in order to take you backwards and forwards. If you understand that the Torah is written all at the end, that's how I'm going to read a Sefer Torah. Of course Bereishis knows Dvarim and Shmos knows Dvarim. It's all being put together to the same way by God to Moshe, which is a very new and exciting way of reading the Torah, as opposed to Megillah, which may change the way that I actually approach the text. So I actually think that this is a very important idea, and we'll develop this in the literary angle of it in a minute. This is not just a technical debate, but this is actually going to the question of how was it written and how do I read it? I just want to show you a source, which I'm not going to read with you, but I want you to see source number 18, just for a second. Source number 18 is a Chazon Ish. Now, the Chazon Ish, this is a written translation of the Chazon Ish. Now, I do apologize. Well, actually, I didn't do anything wrong, but the translation was taken from Rabbi Yaakov Haber's website, Torah Lab. And I took it some years ago. And I now went on the link, and the link is broken. So I don't know if it's just temporarily broken or whether it's broken for good. And I actually know who runs the website, so I'll try and find out. But if you try this link, you won't find it right now. But I promise you, this is what I got from the link when it wasn't broken. And the Chazon Ish actually had a very interesting interface with a young man back in there. I don't exactly know when, the 1940s, I imagine early 50s or 40s. And this young man had been exposed to biblical criticism and the documentary hypothesis and was concerned as to how an authentic Jewish Orthodox approach is going to look at these issues of what was written when and how, etc. And the Chazon Ish actually includes this. It's a real gem that not everybody knows. In this part of the Chazon Ish, he talks about all of these ideas we've been talking about. And I just want to bring out one point here. He says, just look at the last three paragraphs. Where he says here, and at the plains of Moab, this is Sefer Dvarim, the commandments were taught to him a third time. He goes with Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Yishmael, we usually go with Rabbi Akiva, more of that in a minute. And the divine presence was, as it were, speaking from the throat of Moshe. And at this time, he was commanded to write them down in accordance with the language that had been spoken to him in the case of each individual section at the time that had been commanded to transmit it to the people of Israel. So it's getting more and more complex. What language is he using it? He said, among them were commandments that were written in the language in which he'd received them at Sinai, and the commandments in the language had been said to him in the Ohel Moed, and some in the language of the plains of Moab. And there were some that had been repeated and some that were taught a third time. And there were changes, last paragraph, in the language in the case of some commandments that had been taught at Sinai in the Ohel Moed in the plains of Moab. And this variation was to hint to us in his written form, the Torah was taught to Moshe in the form of Torah Shebaal Peh, and he's going with the version of Chatumah. So the Chazon Ish also thinks that this is important enough to flag to this young man. He says, just be aware that you shouldn't be reading, he's saying to him, the Torah like a diary. You shouldn't be reading it in installments, because that's not exactly how it works. And I'll give you a good example of this. I'm sorry, I really am having you run around this sheet a little bit. But just look for a second on page 6, on source 26. Actually, I'll probably keep you on this page from now on for a while. Look at source 26. Every now and then you come across a pasuk and you scratch your heads and you think, how does that work? Here, at the end of Parshas Beshalach, the Jewish people are coming out of Egypt. The man has fallen, says the pasuk, Ubnei Yisrael achlu et haman. The Jewish people ate the man, arba'im shana, for 40 years, ad bo'am el eretz nashavet, until the land that they came to the land they settled, es haman achlu ad bo'am el kisat eretz kna'an. So you're going to ask yourself, 40 years? Who's talking 40 years in Parshas Beshalach? Parshas Beshalach, they're just going straight up. Yeah? Few weeks, pick up the Torah, get to Eretz Yisrael. It's not going to be 40 years. So why is it talking 40 years? Because if you say, no, everything is written at the end and it's flashing back and flashing forward and da-da-da-da-da. So how else are you going to explain that pasuk? If it's installments, this is a strange installment to be writing there. So there are more pasukim like this. Okay, while we're on this theme, let's talk about the Netziv. The Netziv says a very beautiful idea in his Hakdama to the Chumash. The Netziv was the Rosh Hashiva of the Lozhen. Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in the 1800s. He died in the 1890s, and he was the main pillar of, that's why they call him the Netziv. That was obviously his name, but Netziv is a pillar, okay? There was a book written many years ago by Art Scroll called My Uncle the Netziv, which I don't want to talk about now. It has a whole story, backstory to it. It was a translation of a book written by the Netziv's son, the Netziv's nephew, excuse me, that's the whole point, the Torah Tzmima, who wrote in the Makor Baruch an account of his uncle's life. And then when Art Scroll wrote it, they censored it and they changed certain parts of it. And then anyway, it got banned and then everybody got up and screamed. And then they said, well, actually, maybe the original that was written in Hebrew by the Torah Tzmima was also a little bit like broad in its understanding of reality. So maybe their censorship actually brought it back into line with reality. Not going there. You can, if you're into things like this, then I suggest you read Professor Mark Shapiro's blogs where he goes into this in great detail. But have a look now at the Netziv's understanding of Chumash. The Netziv gave a Chumashir in the Lozhen, which I've been told not many of the Bocharim came to, which I can't verify, but rings true, honestly. And he turned that into the Perush of the Netziv on the Chumash. Number 27. Va'ata kisvu lachem et hashira hazot. Write down this shira. Now, what is the shira? So look at this netziv with me in 28. This is a source I want to look at in some detail. Behinim ben nedarim. He quotes from nedarim. Halu beperish hamikra kisvu lachem et hashira. The Gemara there says this word shira shehu kol haTorah says it means the whole Torah. And he brings a proof from the end of that pasuk because it says Laman ti eli hashira hazos le'ed. This is your testimony. This is your proof, etc. Hamia yesh lahavin, says the Netziv. We need to understand. Heich nikra kol haTorah shira. In what way can you call the whole Torah a shira? It doesn't look like a shira. Meaning there are parts of the Torah which do look like poetry. And they're written in a stanza type or poetic type way. Shirat Hayam, Shirat Hazinu, etc. But when you read Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, you know, Vayadaber Hashem el Moshe leimor, and it doesn't look like a poem to me. It looks like a piece of prose. He says, Ela, al korchach, you have to say, Yesh ba teva uskulat hashira. Torah, every part of Torah has the nature and the hidden qualities of a shira, of a poem. Shehu dibu beloshen melitza, which is in figures of speech. It's written in parables. It's written in metaphors. Diyadu alachem, because you know full well, mi bein am Talmud, people who are educated, know, de meshune hamelitza misipur prosi, that poetry and prose are two different beasts. In two ways, but like I'm going to explain to you, the nature and the hidden qualities. Aleph, and he says, the bashir ein ha'inyum mavul yafa. When it comes to a poem, things are not always what they seem. Come on, b'sipur prosi. When you're reading prose, when you're reading the New York Times or the Washington Post, well, you may argue things are also not as they seem when you're reading those papers. But in theory, you're not meant to be interpreting it like poetry. You're reading poetry, you're reading prose, you're reading, it is what it is. What you see is what you get. But poems are not like that. You need to bring out, you know, outside ideas. This stanza is alluding to this idea. And this stanza is alluding to a different idea. If you write an essay for your undergraduate or postgraduate degree, you're doing an English literature degree, and somebody, they give you a sonnet of Shakespeare. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. And you write down, please explain Shakespeare's focus in this sonnet. And you just write, well, Shakespeare's going out for a walk in the park with his girlfriend, whatever. I'm not getting into whether Shakespeare would have had a girlfriend or not. That's a different discussion. you won't get any marks for that. You're meant to say, no, this line is an allusion to Act 4, Scene 3 of Hamlet. And you're meant to bring it all together and show that Shakespeare, he's a very, very powerful author, and he's alluding to many, many things. Says the Nitziv, second line of Aleph, he says, V'loy mikre drush. That's not called drush. That's called pshat. That's pshat. That's what the Chumash means. Okay, drush and pshat are often fairly relative, and Nechama Leibovitz's famous line that pshat is what I say and drush is what you say. There's an element of truth to that. And there's drashi pshat and there's pshati drash. But he says, I'm not even talking about drash. Just how you read the Torah has to be like a poem. Elakachu teva hashir. That's the nature of poetry. Afilu shel hedyot. Even if it's written by not by God, by a regular person, lahavdil, like by Shakespeare. Someone who really knows what they're doing can bring to this metaphor, Belitza Zo, Shinishabe Alav Matok. He can bring sweet ideas, Matok, it's sweet to him. Or La Shon Shel Ashir, the beautiful light of the language of the poem is so sweet. The Diktuka and its details, Harbe Yotemele Me Isha Ein Lo Yidia Mitchunat HaInyan. Someone who doesn't know how to read poetry is just going to mess it up. They're not going to read it properly. They're not going to see the depth. V'rak bale hitzponen min amalitza toref ha'inyan. Someone uneducated will just get the basic idea. It's not what it's really there. U'mize alul hu l'hash'arot b'duyot, and therefore he'll misunderstand it. Mashaloi haya me'olam. And he'll read things which were never there. V'loi l'zeh kiven ha'mashorer. And he won't understand what the writer was trying to intend. Now, just let me stop there for a second. The Nitziv is saying something very, very fascinating. That if you just read the Torah in a very straightforward and literal way, you won't understand it. You'll make up stuff that's not there. Because you're not meant to read it like that. You're meant to read it like a poet. And if you can't read poetry, then go and learn poetry and learn how to read it. Meaning, the Nitziv wouldn't have said, go and do an English degree in Hebrew U. But, I mean, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would, I'm sure, argue it can't harm. And the fact that he had a doctorate from Harvard in English literature was an immense tool that Rav Aaron used in his understanding of Chumash and of Tanakh. And therefore, says the Nitziv, this is not drush. And at the end where I've underlined, loy nikra drush, elakach hu pshat hamikra. So how we read the Torah, which depends on how it was given and whether this pasuk links with this pasuk and that pasuk links with that pasuk, you have to do this in an extremely deep way, which requires an understanding that things are not always as they seem. And in the second paragraph, he goes on to say that poetry also contains patterns. Sometimes it's alphabetic, can be an acrostic. Sometimes you're looking for hints and connections between different words, and things rhyme and things. He says that's the kind of structure that you're also looking for in Chumash. He's telling you, look for these structures. And of course, if you're into, you know, the Gush Torah, chiastic structures are everywhere. First of all, you've never heard of a chiastic structure. And then someone explains the chiastic structure and it goes A, B, C, D, C, B, A. And D is in the middle, and each one reflects the other. And then there comes a point when you start seeing chiastic structures in everything. You know, this whole book is a chiastic structure, and this whole perek is a chiastic structure. And then it's saying, you know, kol hakavod, you know, go and work out what it means. By the way, the Nitziv also says something interesting, which is, if you get this, then you'll understand what the author really intended. Now, how do you do that with Torah exactly? Meaning, maybe I can get to the depths of what Shakespeare intended, maybe. Okay, but what possible hope do I have of getting to the depths of what an infinite author intended in a book? How does an infinite author write a book? That's a good question. And then you have to ask yourself, well, are you ever really, when you're reading literature, trying to work out what the original person meant? Or are you trying to work out what it actually means to you in today's world? Which is an important question in law. When lawyers are reading the U.S. Constitution, are they trying to work out how would Benjamin Franklin have reacted if he was teleported to 2024 and looked at what we're looking at? What would he have said? Very few people argue that, because Benjamin Franklin would have probably run and jumped off a cliff if he could have seen how everything worked out in 2024. And I'm not sure he would have interpreted the way the Supreme Court do, but that's a separate question. So there's Torah as poetry as well. And then the last question I want to bring you with today, to bring to you today, is this issue of chronology. Now, hopefully, you'll get an understanding of when we say Ein Mukdum Umuchar B'Torah. What is that? Why do we say Ein Mukdum Umuchar B'Torah? Is it just some, I know some of my students seem to think it's just something that Mefarshim say when they can't work out what it means. Oh, it's not chronological. Hopefully you see now that it's actually much, much more fundamental that we have to say Ein Mukdam U'Mocha B'Torah, and everybody agrees of Ein Mukdam U'Mocha B'Torah. Okay, Rashi and the Ibn Ezra are more ready to use Ein Mukdam U'Mocha B'Torah, and I brought you those sources, and the Ramban is less ready to use that. And that's why, for example, like I mentioned, the Ramban looks at the parshas of the Chet HaEgel and the Mishkan as chronological, and therefore the Mishkan precedes the Chet HaEgel. Also parshas Korach, which we're coming up to soon, the Ibn Ezra understands the parshas Korach didn't happen in Bamidbar, not there in Bamidbar. It happened when Moshe separated off the Levim from the rest of the people, and all the machlokas started up at the beginning of Bamidbar, before the sin of the spies. And Korach is just placed later on thematically, because now that we're listing all the things that went haywire, so we'll list this and we'll list that. But actually, Korach was before the sin of the spies, not after the sin of the spies. And the Ramban says, no, it was before this, it was after the sin of the spies, because I'm more likely to take it chronologically. But he agrees that from time to time, it's clearly not chronological. Sometimes it's explicitly. Sefer Bamidbar begins in the second month of the second year, and then later goes back to the first month of the second year when it deals with Pesach Sheni. Okay? So this idea of Ein Mukdam U'Mocha B'Torah is not some kind of get-out. It's now fundamental to how we read Torah as to how we understand when it was given. One final point, and I will leave you on Shpilkas, hopefully, until next week. There is a major discussion about the last eight psukim in the Torah. Just look for a second, and I'm going to bring you these sources in outline and give you a little teaser for next week. Just go back for a second to page number 3 and look at source number 12. Now, the Chumash did say that Moshe wrote the Torah ad tumam. He wrote the whole thing. Ramban says, Vayichtav Moshe es haTorah hazot mitchilat breishit ad le'enei kol Yisrael. He wrote the whole thing. He gave them a full Sefer Torah right until the last words of Vezos HaBrocha. And the Rambam in number 13 says the same thing. But there's a problem with that. What's the problem with that? The last 8 psukim of the Torah Moshe is dead. And the last 12 psukim of the Torah Moshe has gone. He's left. So this gives rise to an interesting debate in the Gemara, which I'll just quickly mention to you in number 14, where they say as follows. Am Rabbi Shua bar Abba, Am Rab Gidl bar Amarav. Shmona psukim sheba Torah, the last 8 psukim of the Torah. Yachid kara asam bebeis haknesses. An individual can read them in shul. It's different to the rest of the Torah. Next week we'll see what that means. Come on, who does this follow? Certainly not Rabbi Shimon. Datania v'yama sham Moshe eved Hashem. How can it be? Efsha Moshe chai. How can Moshe be alive? V'kasav and write down v'yama sham Moshe. This is sheker. How can Moshe write sheker? How can that be? Moshe writes, and Moshe died, he's alive. Ella, it has to be, says the first opinion, ad kan kasav Moshe, from this point, up to this point Moshe wrote it, mikan ve'elech kasav Yoshua binyun. Yoshua finishes off the Sefer Torah. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, that's Rabbi Yehuda's view. Amaloi Reb Shimon, evshe Sefer Torah chasa ois echad. Moshe Rabbeinu gave them Apostle Sefer Torah. He handed over Apostle Sefer Torah with 8 psukim missing, maybe 12 psukim missing. Chas v'shalom, chas v'shalom, chas v'shalom. It's that he wrote these psukim with tears. He wrote them in a different way. We'll see what that means. Was he crying or was he taking tears out of his eyes, sort of Harry Potter-like, and using the tears to write things down? You obviously never watched Harry Potter. It's fine. You didn't miss anything. You missed mamash nothing, okay? Okay, don't worry. If you never read The Lord of the Rings, then you missed out. But J.K. Rowling, you can live without. It's fine. And the Ibn Ezra actually goes with Rabbi Yehuda. Look at the Ibn Ezra, and we'll see the Ibn Ezra, we'll finish with him, but we'll start with him next time. V'yal Moshe, lefi dati, according to my opinion, he says, ki mizeh ha-pasuk kosav Yeshua. Yeshua wrote these psukim. Ki acha she'ala Moshe lo kosav. U'bedech nevua kosavu. But he wrote them because he was a novi. You can't have any Joe Schmo just write psukim in the Sefer Torah. Yeshua was a novi. He was a novi. Yeshua opens, God speaks to him. So that's okay, he says. And later also where it says, and God buried Moshe in Moav, in Har Nevo. So look at number 17, Rashi, Ibn Ezra says, and well, I read you 16 first, because this is the key word. Vayikpor osa begei be'eretz Moav, mul beit por, velo yada ish et kvurato ad hayom hazeh. Ad hayom hazeh. To this very day, nobody knows when Moshe is, where Moshe is buried. Now, if you know Rav Bazak, Rav Aaron Bazak, he wrote a whole sefer called Ad Hayom Hazeh, which we'll allude to next time a little bit. And it sounds like it's written later. The Ibn Ezra says, okay, no problem. Number 17, Ad Hayom Hazeh, Divrei Yoshua. It's still Yoshua. V'yitachen shekasav zeh ba'achrit yamav. But it's not Yoshua the week later. It's Yoshua at the end of Yoshua's life. Okay, fine. So now we have Pesukim being put into the Torah by Yoshua decades later. Anyone have a problem with that? Clearly not the Ibn Ezra, but other people do have a problem with that, and we'll get to that next week. But hopefully, just to summarize, and we'll finish here this week, and again, I'm sorry we started 5 minutes late. You can see how every minute is needed. The way the Torah was given, both by God to Moshe, and in writing by Moshe to the world, is extremely relevant. It's not just a theoretical idea. And as we go into Shavuos and we talk about Kabbalah Satara, these are ideas that we can pick up and run with and help us deepen and appreciate our understanding of Torah itself. Have a nice week. We'll see you next week, please God.